on recording. And I will look into that later on. So welcome all to this week's Q&A session. We don't have a huge amount of material this week so far, so there should be time for questions and answers if people are interested in additional questions they have or comments. I'm going to mute everybody right now. If I can find the where are we? Mute all. Okay, so everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a comment or a question, or use the chat window. And if you do unmute yourself, please remute yourself after your question or comment, so that we'll keep background noise to a minimum. The slides, the audio, and the contents of the chat window will go up on our website later on this evening. And with that, I will let Alan lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. We may have less material than we think. I noticed one of our scheduled speakers hasn't joined us yet.
Yeah.
So we may have to skip that one. Anyway, welcome, everyone. We do have a few items in the pipe, but we'll welcome your questions later on if we have lots of time. First thing up, we have Chris with a share about the dreaded Windows 11.
Dreaded Windows 11. Keep in mind that I have yet to actually use Windows 11, so I'm just doing this from reading on the web. And one of the big bugaboos with Windows 11 in terms of being able to use a local account if you wanted a local account rather than a Microsoft account was that while Pro would let you set it up using a local account, Windows 11 Home would not. You had to use a Microsoft account, and the workaround of, you know, disconnecting from the network until you were finished the setup apparently didn't actually work. One of the things that was not so bad with it was that it's only the initial account that had this restriction, and so you could set up, you know, a dummy account or, you know, a rescue account or something like that that would be an administrator that you never actually use. And you could set it up as a Microsoft account and fine. And then you could go in, you could set up any number of additional accounts, whether they be local or Microsoft accounts. Well, I was reading on Thurrott.com, and Paul Thurrott mentioned that starting with Windows 11 22H2, which apparently is out now, the initial setup, both Home and Pro, required using a Microsoft account, as opposed to Pro allowing the local account. So for those who actually prefer to use local accounts, there was that workaround where you could just do the initial setup using a Microsoft account and then create a local account for your normal day-to-day use. Or Paul Thurrott actually had a process that allows you to create the initial account using a local account. And it's actually not all that difficult to do. So next. So when you get to the part of the installation routine where they say, let's add your Microsoft account and enter in no@thankyou.com. And it's actually important that you actually use that exact email address, no@thankyou.com. Because that is a Microsoft account right now that is locked due to it being used too many times with a bad password. And this is an important thing. You need to be using a Microsoft account that is actually locked. And so you just put that in the sign-in field and then click the next button and next. In the password field, you can enter anything you want. And you'll get that message saying, oops, something went wrong. And that's because the account has been locked because it was used with an incorrect password too many times. So then you click the next button, and then you can just enter in a local account. So, you know, just ignore that blue line that says, even better, use an online account. So just enter in a local account number, name, and you're away to the races. So that's the way to do it. If you want to see the advantages and disadvantages of using a local account, Alan and I wrote articles on setting up a new computer and things you should do. And one of the things that we talked about in there was using a local account versus a Microsoft account. And I'll paste that and the Thurot URL into the chat window. And so that's all I have to say on Microsoft accounts on Windows 11.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Tom has joined us, so if you can make him a co-host.
He will do.
Because the next item is a share from Tom on network switching.
Okay, Tom, you are now, you are now a co-host. So you can take over and share your screen. And unmute yourself.
Okay. I think I've done both, so let's see. Let's move that up there. Ooh, that's cute. Okay, I will share my screen. And that looks right. Okay, can you see the set man?
Yes, but it's not in full screen mode yet.
Okay, but okay, well, NetSetMan is a free program that you can use. The main purpose of it is to have quick network switching for your PC.
Tom, we are still just seeing it in the outline view and that, so we're not seeing the slideshow view.
That's weird.
So you might have to just share a different window.
Yeah. Okay, stop the share. Share screen. Is that better?
Yes.
Okie dokes. So it's a free program for non-commercial use. If you use it a lot or use it commercially or have lots of networks that connect to, then it's a good idea to change it, to pay for it. So this is what it is. It's freeware with a premium upgrade, and what it does basically is it shows and changes network settings and allows you to switch between networks quickly and completely, and this is where it's accessible at. If you right-click on it in your tray, this is the display you get on the right. It shows your public IP, how long your system has been up, all of 17 minutes. 17 hours, I guess. And what your Ethernet connection is. This is my wired Ethernet. And what your Wi-Fi connection is. This is my Wi-Fi connection. And Bluetooth. In this case, it's disconnected. You have quick access via the taskbar item. If you right-click on it, you get these choices, and these are the profiles that I've set up, wired linked to my TP router, hotspot on my phone, USB wired, wireless Mi, which I have another router, a Mi router, and wired Mi. As well, you can do these other things as well, Windows Tools, NetSetMan, and other choices that you can use to tell yourself more about your network connections. If you open NetSetMan, this is what you get. These are the profiles that you can set up. This is my wireless Mi setup. And you can set a whole bunch of things here for each network that you connect to. The IP in the gateway, the DNS server you want to use, advanced TCP IP settings, which I don't use. But there are other useful things like whether it's Wi-Fi, what driver you're going to use, what printer you're going to use, and a bunch of other things that will vary from network to network. If you're at work, you may have a particular printer that you want to use, a particular email connection you want to use, a particular host file you want to use, and a particular script to run when you log into that network. In the TCP IP settings, when you open them to set things, this is what the things you can set. You can set your IP, what your IP address is going to be, what gateway you're using, that's your gateway to the internet. And there's the same thing for IPv6 if you're using it. You set up your DNS server, WIN server, and a variety of other things. Root table, which I have never used. DNS suffix, which I have never used. The system settings are things you can set up things like your display mode, wallpaper, desktop color, and so on. You can set up all these so when you choose a particular network to that you're going to be connected to and log into, such as at work or in the library or at a cafe, you can choose all these things to be automatically set for you when you log into that network, when you choose your profile to log into it. Miscellaneous. You can also set these profiles to start up when you see the network, when you are connected to that network, when you connect it to a particular router using Wi-Fi or Ethernet, and you can enable auto switch so that for each particular profile. So that when you come into work automatically, everything is set up for you. When you come home again, automatically it's set up for you. You can also set up auto runs. For example, this is a script file you can set up, deleting temp files and so on, and what programs you want to run on your profile activation. Now, you can also set your auto switch conditions, so it can be set on what are the Wi-Fi networks nearby, what are the network locations, your adapter status, which adapter you're using, by time frame and by user account. If someone else is using your computer on a different account, then they can actually have that set up for themselves as well for auto-switching. You can, as well, within this program, you can see what's available to you on Wi-Fi and how strong the networks are, what their SSIDs are, if they have one, their MAC address, the encryption, channels, and so on, and what kind of Wi-Fi you have. Or they have. If you go into details, you can get this particular detail. So you can distinguish wireless network. You can add additional descriptions, such as this in this case, it starts off with the MAC, but you can specify a color and so on. So that all these can be colored. So you can actually choose, for example, if you're in a work setting where there are several routers that you could choose between. You can actually set up the colors so that they match so that they are distinguished from each other, and you can choose the color. It simplifies your clicking and choosing. You can also connect to a particular wireless network. This is the from the tray. This is the icon here in the tray. And you can connect to a particular wireless network or disconnect. Here I'm already connected. It's in bold. It also has a variety of information that you can display. These are the network tools. If you go back, this is the NetSet Man tools. And one of the things you can do are ping, not pring, traceroot, net, NS lookup, netstat, and ipconfig. So you can actually choose these in here and run them. So you can actually, here I run a ping and then I ran a traceroot. And then this is the result of the traceroot. In the console, you can also see what is what is attached to your network in the network scanner. That's this thing here. If it's this adapters, details, network scanner, connections, this is the network scanner. And you can see what's here and whether they're active and what is how things are connected and what the delay is. So this is a Seagate 4 terabyte network attack storage. This unknown is my computer. These are a variety of other things I have attached inside of my network. In the adapter's details, you can see what things are attached: the Ethernet adapters, the Wi-Fi, or the Bluetooth. In this case, which I've expanded to show what the details are, so you can explore those details. In the connections, you click it to run it, and you can see what your current connections are at any particular time. This is my Oculus. This is the Oculus server. This is something to do Armory Creative's stuff for my NVIDIA card, Chrome, the browser, and so is Firefox. So you can see your connections and who they're connected to. TomTom system, TomTom. Tom is my user ID. You can also go into the Windows tools, and these are the choices you have. Network connections, places, Wi-Fi management. So you can go to the Windows tools directly from here without having to go into settings. Here is the feature list for NetSat Man. So this is NC free, and as you can see, most things are free. The things that aren't free are using a proxy, using a domain, commercial use, and use with Windows Enterprise Server. And you're also limited to 8 profiles. For the paid version, which costs from 25 to 49 euros, it's unlimited, the number of different networks you can set up. But these are all the things that you can do. You can set up the host file entries, queues between files. You can do a variety of things to manage your network connection. And even if you're always stay at home and you're connecting to one network all the time, it's useful to have all these tools available to you. So in summary, it's easy to completely set up how you connect to networks. You have quick switching, even auto switching based on a variety of criteria. Networking details are easily available, and network tools. And it's free, and you can choose Pro for more profiles or commercial use. And there's much, much more, as you can see from the features. Check the help file when you go into NetSat Man, and that will explain it for you. And I'm done.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Tom. There's nothing in the chat. If anybody has any questions, you can unmute your microphone and ask away.
I will ask. Tom, why?
Yes. Why?
Why? Yes.
Okay. The answer to that is the first reason you would use NetSat Man is that you want to be able to switch between different networks that you commonly use automatically or by choice, and have everything set up for that. Your printer, your network shares, all this other stuff. So that's the first reason and the most important reason on why this was created. The second reason, even if you stay at home, is that you can manage your network settings through NetSat Man by going in and looking at things and then changing them for your, you know, the one proxy or the one profile that you've already set up. So it's to manage your network. If you have no need to manage your network, if you're not switching between networks, it's less advantageous. If you only have one network, then it just makes it a little bit easier to manage and set up your network associated information.
Yeah, I'm still not seeing, I mean, okay, I know router guy. I've never been. I knew enough to get myself by. I guess I'm still, because I run with machines and I go from home networks to domain networks and backwards and forth, again, I'm still struggling as to see what the use would be of this program, other than if you wanted finite control of your network. And it's one of those things that, sure, you could have that finite control, but what does your efforts gain you in the end?
Mainly it's to remove interference. When you're working at home, you have your own particular printer, you have your own network shares, you have your own other things. And when you go to your office with your laptop, then it's all different. Network shares are different. Your VPN, you don't have the VPN, et cetera, right. Et cetera. So it's the main reason is a convenience thing to be able to set these up automatically once for each location. And then when you take your PC there, you're already set up. And when you take your PC back home or to another location, again, it's automatically set up. If you don't move between locations, it's less advantageous. The only advantage is to set it up similar to how you would set it up in using Windows networking tools. So it's if you're staying in one place, it's a minor convenience. If you're moving to different places, then instead of having to, you know, go in and set up all these things each time you move, your printer, your network shares, etc., you just have to open your computer and it automatically switches. That's the advantage of it.
Okay, but that's the whole point of having a DHCP server on your router, or if you go into a corporate network or if you go into a hotspot, you know, that's typically where all that is taken care of. You're given an IP address and you're made part of a domain that you are connected to.
But I don't believe that your shares are going to automatically switch for you. Just as an example, your shares or printer availability will not necessarily just change because your network has changed. So I could definitely see a convenient factor there. Even the idea of automatically switching to using a VPN if I'm away from home. So if I'm on a public Wi-Fi hotspot, I could see it being really convenient that it just automatically turns on the VPN or turns it off if I'm at home. You know, that sort of idea. You know, network shares, the same thing. You don't want to have network shares showing up and having Windows trying to connect to something that it has no hope of connecting to, and it's just, you know, wasting its cycles trying to connect to something that it's not going to be able to see anyways.
I guess I just in regards to network shares, I know that, for example, on our systems, we have network shares. The biggest issue we have is that when the VPN comes on, Windows doesn't always remember to bring back the map drives that you previously set up, but it only does it on the odd occasion. Most of the time, the VPN comes on, your shares come on, and you're off to the races. When you disconnect the VPN, your shares disappear or you're no longer connected to the shares, and you're just on your home network. So I guess this seems like a great tool, but I'm still at a loss as to why I would use for it.
Yeah.
It depends,
yeah.
I guess.
No, I get it.
It depends on the amount of changes you have to do manually every time you move from one place to another. You have to set up your...
But that's my point. I'm not aware of anyone that has to go in and change their network settings. In fact, if I had my colleagues having to do anything with network settings, they would throw up their arms and saying, I have no idea. You're expected to create corporate laptops we set up. They automatically work whether at home or whether the VPN is connected. So, I just don't see the need for something. But maybe
okay,
I'm
going to jump in here. There's some comments in the chat. Some people think it's a great tool, and some people agree with Lawrence that maybe it's a niche tool. They don't have a niche for it, but clearly there's a difference of opinion here. Anyway, let's move along. We need to keep going and do some more things. So thanks very much, Tom, and I'm sure you're available for more detailed questions on email if anybody wants to discuss it further. Okay, the next item is a question that came in a long time ago from Micheline. She had a raft of questions about smartphones. And this one's kind of interesting. She wants to know about mouse click equivalents on Android devices. So she's asking, how do you do a left click and a right click? And what's the equivalent of the other keys, Shift, Control, Alt, and the Windows special key? So it turns out that there's a mouse built into your phone. And certainly left clicking is really easy. You just tap on the screen, and that's the equivalent of a left mouse click. A right click, you can actually do two things. If you tap on the screen and hold it down, which they call a long press, then that will generally bring up some kind of context menu, whatever the right click or the long press is going to do. And a variant on that is instead of tapping with one finger, which is a left click, you tap with two fingers, and that gives you the equivalent of a long press or a right click. For the other keys, certainly if you bring up an on-screen keyboard in any kind of word processing, text entry type application, you will find on the keyboard there's a shift key in the usual place because, as you can see here on the keyboard, you've got lowercase letters, and every now and again, maybe you'd like to add a capital letter, for example. So there's certainly a shift key available on the on-screen keyboard on your Android device. However, typically, you don't, as you can see here, there is no control key and there's no alt key. Android typically doesn't use those things. However, as with all things Android, things can be customized and changed and added to. And if you look on Google for control and alt keys on Android devices, you may come across several options, one of which is this thing called the Hacker's Keyboard. And this is an app which you can load into an Android phone or a tablet. You get a different keyboard, and clearly for this thing you get a control key and an alt key. I'm not sure what you would do with them. I've never tried this, but I don't have any applications that need those keys. But if you do, then clearly it's available as an add-in third-party app. The Windows key is a different story. So I asked Andy, the robot, and he said, what was that, a Windows key? And he laughed and he laughed. He said, no. We don't have a Windows key on an Android device. So there you go. Those are the Windows key equivalents that I know about and can find out about on Android smartphones and tablets. Okay, so moving along, Bob Walker now has an online demo, I think. He's going to fire up his chainsaw and rip a few CDs apart.
Okay, so let me just share the screen here. And some of us who give presentations fairly frequently joke about the demo gods and how when you're doing a live demo, something will always go wrong. And sure enough, this morning when I went to run through this for a bit of practice there, my CD-DVD player died. And I had to rush into Ottawa to get a new one. And then later in the afternoon, the fax on my printer refused to work and had to run the document in myself. And then my Keurig coffee maker bit the dust. This is a six-month-old machine, and this will be the third time it had to be replaced. So we'll see how this goes. So we're going to start by ripping a CD. So let me start up ExpressRip, and you can see here I've already set up the output folder location, and you usually do this once when you first install it, and it's you use the same one forever after that. The output format is the same. I have it set for MP3. There's a whole raft of formats you can use if you prefer something else. Up here, it shows the drive. Now, with some models of CD, DVD players, this window will remain blank until you put a CD in the drive, and then you may still have to select it. In this case, with this new drive, it shows up fine anyway. So let's pop a CD into it. And there we go. Now ExpressRip will read the CD. It's loading in the table of contents. Did that in just a couple seconds. And it showed up the right information here. The artist is Phil Collins. The album is Face Value. It slits at all the songs that are on the CD. If there's some you don't want to rip, you just uncheck them. Otherwise, you're good to go. And we'll rip the CD. Now, while this is happening, this will take a few minutes to finish off the CD. So let's have a look at music tag here for tagging. And we'll have a look at where is it here? We'll choose the directory that the music is in, click OK, and here it's shown up two MP3s that are in that directory. Now, both of these have been ripped from music videos downloaded from YouTube, of course, there's no tags on them whatsoever, so let's choose this one here. And here it's gotten some information off the file name. Now, I haven't cleaned up the file name. This is the way it came downloaded from YouTube, and we'll cover a change in the file name the next session. But here the group's name is Toto. So let's select that. Control-X erases it. And Control-V puts it in elsewhere. The title of the song is correct. It's Africa. So let's just remove that blank space from the beginning. Before we get rid of the rest of it, the year there, 2013, we'll put that in here. We have it, so may as well use it, but normally the main information you're after is the song title, the artist, and the album, if any. So let's go shift, end, and then delete that stuff. It's not required. Now for the album, This is from a live performance in Amsterdam in 2013. And it's from the music video. So you can distinguish that this isn't from a CD or from an album download from iTunes or whatever else. And that's the main information we need here. Now, we need to get an artwork for this. So one of the best places to go is Google Images. And we'll just type in the group name, Toto. And right up here comes up with the suggestion Africa, because this is one of the most popular songs. And it gives you a whole selection here. And sure enough, here's the one that looks like it'd be a great album cover right off the bat, first selection. But you can see there's lots and lots here. So let's just click on this. Oh, my God, that's terrible resolution there. But if you scroll down, here's one that looks a little bit better. Now, you can see here from the size, it's 635 by 629 pixels. That's not too bad. So let's copy this image, and we're going to paste it into IrfanView. Now, IrfanView is a great program here. Chris has done a number of presentations on this as it's developed over the years. Great for image editing. So let's paste that into there. There it is there. Now, if you only want a part of this, IrfanView makes it quite easy to crop and whatever else, but we're not going to do that. We're just going to check on the size of this again. So you can either go image, resize, resample, or you could just do Control R. And here you want to set the size in pixels, because that's what matters to most music players. And anything bigger than 600 by 600 pixels is a waste, because they won't display more than that. But if it's a larger image, it just makes the MP3 file size a little bit bigger. So this is close enough. So we'll click OK, and we'll Control C to copy it. Or no, we'll save this. And here I've got a directory music cover art, which I last used, so it's come up automatically. And we'll call this Toto Africa. Save it. We can close down IrfanView here. And let's just minimize this. So we'll go back to the music tag here, and we'll click on the load artwork from file. Now here I've already set it up for the particular directory. Otherwise, you just choose it like normal. We'll go down and have a look. There's Toto Africa. So double click, and it's loaded in. So we'll have a look at everything here. There's the title, Africa, the artist, the album name, and whatever. So we'll save the changes, and we can close that. Now here's Express Rip. It's finished ripping the album here. We'll just cancel this. And you can see here's where it's put all the files. and that. So we'll close that. Now, let's have a look at that Toto song. And see how it came through. You can see up here in the corner, there's the cover art, there's the song name, the group name, and Live in Amsterdam. So everything has come through properly here. And it's a good tune. Now let's have a look at Phil. Express Rep has downloaded into the directory here. It set up a directory for the artist, Phil Collins, set up a subdirectory for the album. And so if I went and ripped another Phil Collins one, it would be another subdirectory in here. And there are all the songs. Now let's see how this turns out. Now we've got the name of the song. We've got the name of the artist. We've got the name of the album, but there's no cover art. So let's take this off here and open up Music Tag again. And we'll go to open up the album there. And in this case, we're looking for the proper directory. There we are. Phil Collins, face value. Choose it and then hit OK. And here it's loaded all the tunes in. And we'll check here the first song there. And there it's got all the other tagging information right because Express Rip went to a database, made sure everything was correct. Read a lot of this off the CD anyway. But it's got all that stuff, but we just don't have the artwork here. So what we're going to do, we want the artwork added to all the songs. So we'll select all, to choose all the songs at once, and we'll go download missing info. And now it's downloading all the data for each of the tracks. Okay, now it says here displaying match one of two, and usually it can load in anywhere up to dozens of selections for the album artwork. So we'll go to the first song here. That's the correct artwork. Express Rip gave us the title of the song, the artist's name, and the album. And then Music Tag here has added in the album artist, which is the same as the artist, the genre, the year, and this is track number 1 of 12. So it's added this additional information in besides the album artwork here. And if you click on next here, it'll just give you another choice of the album artwork, which is exactly the same. I've already checked. So we're happy with this, and so we're going to save the changes. We'll look at the next song. Again, it's loading in the information. It's got everything correct. This is track two. Again, you have a choice of two different artworks, and you see the little icon here tells you how many choices you got for that particular tune. And some of them are only one choice. And this song here has none, but so song number two, everything's okay the way it is. Save the changes. Go to song number three. Yeah, that's good. Save the changes. Four. Five. Six. Seven.
Can you also just blindly select all and say save changes? Just say, well, yeah, I guess they're probably right.
Yeah, but you see one hit song here is showing no choices here. Yeah. So we'll have a quick look at that, but we'll save what's available. And says it can't find an artwork for this song. Now, this is fairly rare. I've never come across this before. And that's why I wanted to go down to this one. Now, I'm going to cheat a bit here. We're going to go to load artwork from file. And here we are in our artwork directory. And there's Phil Collins, several artworks here. And there's the album Face Value. So we've got our artwork. And you see some of the other information here is didn't come up with the album artist, the genre, or the year or anything. But the main things we're worried about are the song title, the artist, and the album. So we've got all that. We've got the album artwork. And then get the last one here. Save the changes. And then, okay, we're good to go. So let's just see how this shows up in the music player. So we've got the name of the song, the artist, the album, some technical information, and we have the proper cover art here. So we've got everything we need. Now, you notice here that the file names is just the name of the song and the order of the track. And we'll talk about that next session where I talk about how to organize your digital music library. And we're going to look at some database applications that do some of this automatically. And we'll look at how you can organize your music library manually as well, which is the cheaper way. And so that's it for tonight.
Bob, we have one question in the chat. Tom asks, what formats can, I guess, the NCSH software rip into FLAC?
Yeah, let me just pull that up again. Yeah, it can do FLAC, M4As, which is the format that you get stuff from iTunes. It'll do WAVE, WMA, a whole bunch of them here. OGG, there's about 20 or so different formats that it has.
Okay, thanks a lot, Bob. So we'll look forward to another session later on. Okay, so a question came in earlier today. And it's basically to do with a zero-day vulnerability in the Chrome web browser. It's WebRTC is the problem. And the question was, if it affects Chrome, does it affect other things like Firefox and Chromium? Does it affect the search applications, Google and Bing? And if it is a problem, are there other browsers and search engines that you can use that are safe from the vulnerability? Glenn has Chrome version, basically the last digits are 70, and the update is 71, but he's telling me that that's not available on the Play Store. So I looked this thing up. I hadn't actually heard about it. It's fairly recent. You notice this is dated July the 5th, and as it says here, it's a zero-day issue. And if you read the details, it has one of these CVE numbers, so it's a badness, and it's essentially a buffer overflow problem, and that can lead to some issues like arbitrary code execution, which is typically a bad thing. So if you're using Chrome or one of its variants, then you should make sure that you have the patch. And as it says here, the fix is in this article. If you look at the article, it tells you that Google did release a new version of Chrome for both Windows and Android. And indeed, it's fixed by this version 71 at the end here. And that was released on July the 4th. So if you don't have automatic updates for Chrome browser and its siblings, you might want to check and make sure you get this patch. I actually looked on my phone. I don't use Chrome, but I actually use Opera, and Opera is a variant on Chromium. And there was this patch was available to 71. So it is available on the Play Store as far as I can see. I don't know why Glenn can't find it. However, Chris has a few comments on general thoughts on vulnerable day issues.
Yeah, I thought it was a good thing to bring up today because in a general sense, these things pop up from time to time where you have zero-day vulnerabilities. So zero-day is when a vulnerability is discovered and there is no patch available for it. So anybody who's an attacker can presumably go out and exploit this particular vulnerability and do bad things to people's computers. And so it is important to deal with all vulnerabilities, and zero days are particularly dangerous because of the fact that you don't have a fix for it. So the first thing I always tell people is, first off, don't panic, because a lot of times, even if there's a zero-day vulnerability out there, doesn't mean that it's necessarily easily exploited on your particular computer. First, it might not be exploited in the wild yet at all. Another thing, it might actually require something like physical access to the device or a particular configuration or something like that. Or maybe it doesn't do necessarily nasty things. If all it does is denial of service attacks, if you get, you know, attacked, basically you might get shut out from a particular site or the internet or something like that, but it won't do damage to your computer. So the first thing is, don't panic. Keep an eye out for the patches, because as soon as somebody announces a zero-day vulnerability, the heat is on the vendor to actually come out with a fix. And you can see that it looks like Google came out within a day with a fixed version. So that's the first thing to do, is you can keep an eye out for the patches. And while you're keeping an eye out for the patches, you know, take a look at the vulnerability. See what it can actually do, you know, in terms of bad things on your computers. Or can you work around it? Can you change to a particular configuration that doesn't allow the exploit to happen on your computer? Or can you use a different program? So, for example, on this one, it was the Chromium engine. So all browsers that are based on Chromium Engine are likely to be vulnerable to this. So what can you do? Well, you could use something else. So you could use Firefox in the meantime, so as your browser. And so that would be a workaround that you could deal with. Now, it's getting to be a pretty shrinking field of alternative browsers that are not using Chromium Engine, but Firefox is still one of them. So that's good reason to have it around, I guess. If it's in another piece of software, maybe you can use an alternate piece of software until such time as the fix actually comes out. But just keep an eye on things. If you don't understand what it's all about or anything like that, ask somebody who does. Bring it up at Q&A. You know, other people may have an idea about that particular vulnerability and how best to deal with it. So just general sense, that's a good idea, good approach, I think, for dealing with zero-day vulnerabilities.
Yeah, thanks very much, Chris. And I actually do use both Opera and Vivaldi, and they're both based on Chromium, so that would be a problem, except that Firefox is the default browser for Linux, so I have that as a backup. Okay, next thing, we have a share from Linda. Who's going to unmute her microphone and tell us about it.
Okay, well, thanks, Alan. So this is just a fun little, very non-scientific research that I've been doing. So, you know, we hear about the scammers and that trying to get you to open emails with enticing subject lines. But I was thinking about, well, how do you just reach the people that don't always write back to you as fast as you'd like? So I know, you know, if I write to Chris, I'm going to hear back quickly. If I write to my younger sister, I'll hear back quickly. But there's people in my life I'd like to hear back quickly, but it's not really an emergency. So I can't really say, oh, this is an emergency. You got to talk to me right away. So I was just been experimenting in the past few months with what kind of subject lines might get people to open an email. And we all know the congratulations you have won and all that. That's not going to work. I could say I need your help, but then they might be a little hesitant. I may be asking them to help me wallpaper or something. So they don't necessarily want to open that email. I could say I need your advice as a subject line. Well, that's kind of flattering, but again, it might mean work for them. They might not have time to read. They know they're going to have to respond because I'm asking for advice. So over time, what I found to be is, next slide, please, the best line that you can use in a subject is "you were right." And every single time I send an email to someone with that subject line, I hear back right away because everybody wants to know, what was I right about? Oh, this is nice. And it doesn't require me to write an email or give help or wallpaper a wall or anything. So if anybody wants to try that, I find it is absolutely irresistible. People, it appeals to their ego, and they just want to know, what was I right on? And yeah, it doesn't mean they're going to reply to you, but they do, because then they're in a good mood. So I hear back from people right away. So just a tip. So if you're going to be a scammer, that's a good subject line to use.
It'll work at least once, I guess. Huh?
Yeah, it'll work at least once.
Good one.
Okay, thanks very much, Linda. Okay, so we're at that time. We have a minute to go to our scheduled hour. So if anybody has any other questions, now is the time to open up your microphone or put something in the chat window.
Yeah, I don't see anything new in the chat so far. There was a comment from Tom on a website, can help with 0 days. So if anybody's interested in that, you can pick it up in the chat. And other than that, we have nothing else new, so.
Okay, well, let me move along then. And if anybody thinks of anything in the next few minutes, we can come back to it. First thing I want to do is remind everyone that our next regular meeting won't be until September the 14th, in fact. However, that is going to be a members' favorites night. So we're looking for people who want to give presentations at the meeting. As it says on the slide, it can be anything that's computer related. It can be an application that you like, hence members' favorites, a piece of hardware that you purchased that is the best thing since sliced bread, or some kind of tweak to one of the various operating systems that none of us are able to live without. We're suggesting kind of a 10 to 20 minute presentation, but we're pretty flexible on that. So if you have any thoughts of sharing anything with your colleagues and friends in September, please send us an email and we'll be happy to reserve you a slot. no more tech talks. We've done those. There's nothing at the library. We're not allowed to present at the library anymore. So the next thing we have on our agenda is the next Q&A session, which will be next Wednesday, the 13th. If you have any questions that pop up between now and then, or again, if you have interesting topics that you'd like to share, just let us know, and we'll be happy to include you in the agenda. And I don't see anything in the chat in terms of another question. So I think that's it for me, and hope everybody enjoyed the session, and good night from me.
And that's it for me too. Thanks very much to everybody who contributed and attended. We'll see you all next week.